Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:35 p.m. on Thursday, March 31st, 2016. Present, we have Representative Guerra, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Gaddis, and Representative Wilson has a bill up in another committee. I'm sure Representative Edgman and Munoz will be joining us shortly. Before I start, please remember no cell phones, electronic devices allowed in committee. Today we will be introduced to House Bill 247, Tax Credit Interest Refunds Oil and Gas by House Rules by the request of the Governor. We will be addressing the resourced version of House Bill 247, Version I. Here to speak to the bill is Mr. Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division. Dan Stickle, Assistant Chief Economist, is also in the room for questions. And at this time, Mr. Alper, come to the table, put yourself on the record, and please begin your presentation to introduce the bill. He's going to be doing it in sections, so I'd appreciate it that if we'd hold questions, and at the end of each section, we'll have questions on that section, and then we'll move to the next section. At the end of that one, we'll have questions on that section, if that's all right. Mr. Alper, please put yourself on the record.
Sure, I'm going to call
him
at ease, please.
At ease? We're back on the record. Mr. Alper, place yourself on the record and proceed with your introduction of House Bill 247.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue, and thank you for having us here. As you recall, we were here briefly last week with Commissioner Hofbeck giving a high-level overview of the bill. We're here to go into much greater detail as to what's actually into the legislation before you. I want to apologize for Commissioner Hofbeck, who's in transit. He was on the plane out of Anchorage, which is a little bit delayed. I expect him here before the end of the hearing, and hopefully he can join me at the table. I also want to apologize in advance. I have a tendency to talk fast, especially when I have 59 slides in front of me. Please ask me to slow down at any moment when you think that that's necessary.
Mr. Alper, as you finish a section, you can pause and let us know that we are ready for questions on that section. I'd appreciate it. Continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What you see before you on slide two is effectively the table of contents. There'll be title slides for each of these nine items, so that's nine less material slides we need to talk about. We're going to walk through a little bit of history of Alaska's oil and gas tax credit system and how it developed over time. We'll look then at over which credits worked and which didn't, what we could learn from our experience, put some totals on the costs. We're somewhat limited because of confidential data, but we've done our best to aggregate the information and provide what we hope is some insightful totals on the cost of some of these credits. Going to do a little bit of a refresher on the oil and gas tax and credit calculations for several slides. Finally, once we get through all that, I'm going to talk about the actual bill that's before your committee, House Bill 247, the Resources Committee substitute. Afterward, I'll briefly go through some of the changes that were made from a prior version of the bill as introduced by the governor. Finally, the fiscal impact, summary of the fiscal note. You also have a fiscal note before you in much greater detail, which I could discuss at your pleasure. An introduction to a new model that we generated, a life cycle modeling that shows the economics of a specific new field and how it might be impacted by the changes that we're envisioning, and finally, the costs and procedures for implementing the bill itself. So with that as background, we're going to go to the first section, which is called History and Development of Credits. Mr. Chairman, up until 2006, Alaska's oil and gas severance tax or production tax was much simpler. It was based on gross value. It was known for those last decades as the economic limit factor, as the ELF. But even during that ELF era, the legislature added credits, most prominently the alternative credit for exploration, or what we now know as the exploration credit. That was a percentage of a company's expenses that they can get offset from their taxes if they did a desired activity, exploring for new oil or gas a certain distance from existing infrastructure, for example. The credit regime got much more widely expanded in 2006 when the legislature passed the PPT, or Petroleum Production Tax Bill, in the summer of 2006. With the switch to net profits taxation, there were several new credits added, as well as, and you'll hear me referencing the Cook Inlet tax caps. Those are a hold harmless provision that was built into PPT that kept the Cook Inlet taxes as what they were before the effective date of that bill. And also with PPT did we see the beginning of the state starting to repurchase or cash out certain credits. With the ACES bill, Alaska's Clear and Equitable Share, in 2007, this was a substantial tax increase, but for the point of view of credits, what was most important to recognize historically was that was the moment when the repurchase of credits by the state became open-ended. Prior to that, there was a cap of $25 million per company per year. That was lifted with the ACES bill, and since then, we've had a paradigm of buying however many credits have been presented to the state. Finally, in 2010 was the Cook Inlet Recovery Act and related legislation. This was a targeted bill adding a very high-level credits to try to encourage new exploration and development in the Cook Inlet, mostly in light of supply shortfalls, of problems with there being enough supply to keep the lights on. That was important enough to create some very high-level credits. Similar credits were added for the frontier areas to try to encourage people to look for and develop oil in the undeveloped areas of the state, in the interior primarily. That was a 2012 bill. And then lastly, when Senate Bill 21, which was the North Slope oil tax rewrite in 2013, that was a North Slope-focused bill, and it eliminated the so-called spending credits, and I'll get to that a little bit later. All of the capital credits went away for North Slope and were replaced with the per-barrel credit tied to production. So we have two very different tax and credit systems in different areas of the state today. Moving on to slide number 5, so why was this done? Going back to first principles, to encourage certain desired behaviors. We wanted people to be exploring. We wanted to get new oil in the system. We wanted to get new companies to come to Alaska. We wanted more investment. So credits were designed as a mechanism to cause that to happen. Later on, as we got into more complicated net profits-based tax systems, to a certain extent, the credits became baked into the tax formula. You started seeing higher taxes than might have been justifiable on their own, but they were designed to be offset by certain fairly large credits tied to capital expenditures or to base production. What we found as more credit bills were passed and credits were changed over time, as you started seeing layering or stacking of credits, people were able to claim multiple credits for the same activity at times, and that led to some very high dollar figures, some unanticipated circumstances. And when it comes to credits, we have to understand that there's three ways, although for the most part two ways in which they're used. A company who, if they owe taxes, can use a tax credit from the state to reduce their taxes or offset it, use against liability. They can be sold or transferred from a company to another company who has a tax liability, or they could be cashed out or what we call repurchased by the state. And this last, the cashing out or repurchasing, is the primary focus of the legislation before you today, House Bill 247. There's a AS 4355-028 is the portion of statute that creates the repurchasing fund, and within that statute, E4 says that a company producing over 50,000 barrels a day is not eligible for cash repurchases. They could only use their credits to offset their own taxes or carry them forward until they do. Of course, that was primarily written to carve out the three major producers, BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil, although per their own testimony, we now have a fourth major producer in Alaska. Our friends at Hilcorp crossed over the 50,000 barrel of oil equivalent threshold in 2015 between their North Slope and Cook Inlet production. So we now have four majors for all intents and purposes. Slide number six is a summary of the major credits, and these are all in AS 4355 for that last digit that you see in these sections in our statute that are our major credits that are on the books. 023B is the net operating loss, sometimes called the carried forward annual loss credit, between 25% and 45%, depending on the area of the state and the year that we're talking about. That is the main credit that's refunded from the North Slope and by far the largest statewide credit. And that one is what we call stackable, meaning a company can earn an operating loss credit as well as one of the other credits and claim them on the same expenditures in the same year. The 023INJ credit, that is the North Slope per taxable barrel credit. That was the core component of House Bill, Senate Bill 21. The 0 through 8 on legacy oil, it's between $0 and $8 per taxable barrel, depending on the price of oil. On new oil or GVR eligible oil, that's a flat $5 per barrel. Regardless, those are only usable on the North Slope, and they could only be used against tax liability. They cannot be refunded. They cannot be carried forward. Those are what you call use it or lose them credits. In the next set of
Mr. Alper, on acronyms, some of these they get lost with some people. So if you could please go ahead and explain what those are as you get through them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe I introduced an acronym GVR in my last bullet point. That refers to gross value reduction. That is the new oil-specific tax reduction benefit that is a portion of Senate Bill 21 on North Slope fields that meet certain definitions of new oil. And it's the formula of it isn't necessary to this conversation, but I could go into that. The third bullet here is 023A and L. That's the capital and well expenditure credits. You'll sometimes see that called the QCE or Qualified Capital Expenditure Credit is a 20% credit that goes back all the way to PPT. And the WLE or Well Lease Expenditure Credit, that's the 40% credit on those capital expenditures that are specific to drilling wells. That was part of the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, the extra high credit that was created to incentivize additional production in Cook Inlet. Those are generally refunded, and they're right now only available outside the North Slope because the capital credit, the QCE credit, was repealed for the North Slope with the passage of Senate Bill 21. We then have the exploration credits, which I referred to a couple of slides ago. Those are now between 30 and 40%, and those are set to expire on July 1st of this year, meaning to qualify, the expenditure has to be made before July 1st on the North Slope and Cook Inlet. However, the exploration credits have been extended up until the first day of 2022 by prior legislation. I believe, Mr. Chairman, you moved that amendment on the floor to Senate Bill 21 to extend the interior exploration credits for another 5 years. Finally, we have the 024C, what's known as the small producer credit. That is a flat number off the top. A small producer who makes less than 50,000 barrels a day can reduce their tax liability by up to $12 million. That is also a use it or lose it credit. The small producer credit is scheduled to sunset, although I put a bit of an asterisk on that sunset. It is being closed to new applicants on May 1st of this year, in a few weeks. However, once a company is getting the small producer credit, they're eligible to continue to get it for 9 consecutive years of production. So in other words, if someone new comes in under the wire and gets the small producer credit this year, they can get it until 2025. But those companies that might have started collecting the small producer credit in the beginning in around 2008 are now in their last year of being eligible for that credit.
Sure.
And Mr. Chairman, I am in a section break, so I'm going to pause and see if any of your members would like to ask me a question.
Lenny Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Alper, I just want to make sure for the record and for those following, the spreadsheet here has a very good, very useful summation of the tax credits, identifies them. I just want to make sure for the record on the slide, the bullet points you just spoke of, in the middle point 023A&L, the capital is what we call QCE on this chart. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes.
And then further through the chair, well expend is also known as the well lease expenditure, or WLE credit. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Sadler, the L or the 023L is the suite of well lease expenditure credits, and the 023A is the QCE or capital expenditure credits.
And through the chair again, I appreciate the consistency. There's many different credits, many different acronyms. I know for myself and for others trying to watch and for those trying to do the record that having consistent nomenclature is going to go a long way towards eliminating confusion and helping the consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I just, before we get to the next question, on the issue of that specific spreadsheet, which is part of the committee's record and should be available on basis, that was provided to the previous committee, and it references not just the credits but the proposed changes in the bill. That sheet has not yet been updated to the committee substitute, so it doesn't. It's a little bit out of date as far as the actual legislative changes at the bottom of that page.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that this slide right here probably tells most of the story that we need to know about in terms of considering the bill that's in front of the committee. But I'm not asking for affirmation on that, but in that context, can you break down, let's see, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 categories there in terms of what the state is liable for monetary-wise in the budget, the FY17 budget?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, there is another document that's in the committee packet. Actually, I always carry a copy with me because people are always asking for it. It looks something like this, and that's the historic and forecasted tax credits by of the different types by year, by area of the state, by tax credit type. That gives a pretty good high-level summary of it. Over the last couple of years, the credits have been about 50-50 between the North Slope and Cook Inlet. On the North Slope side, probably 90% operating loss credits, and the other 50% are exploration and some miscellaneous. On Cook Inlet, it's a little bit split between the operating loss and the capital/well credits, and then also a small amount of exploration credits. Those are the refundable ones. The credits used against liability are in the North Slope almost entirely the per taxable barrel credit and a small amount of small producer credit. And in Cook Inlet, because the underlying taxes are so low because of the statutory tax caps, there's very little actual credits used against liability. But to the extent they are, they're almost entirely the small producer credit.
Mr. Chairman, can I just...
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, we talked about, for those watching, being able to track this, and there's no way that somebody watching this at home is going to have this information here that we have in front of us. But so can you put a percentage basis, just even a rough ballpark number, going through all five of those categories? Because you mentioned that the top one is the major credit that's refundable, it's stackable. But, I mean, how much of that is what we're talking about here?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I'm going to try to do that, and the biggest caveat is the per taxable barrel credit itself is extraordinarily contingent on the price of oil, so that in FY14, say, that was close to $600 million. But in FY16, it's only going to estimated to be $28 million. So as a percentage, it's widely varying. And so when I make that estimate, it's much easier to sort of carve out the refunded credits from the credits against liability. Of the refunded credits, I would say three-quarters of them are operating loss credits, and a quarter or 20% or so are the capital and well credits, and less than 5% exploration credits.
Committee, any other questions before we move to the next section? Seeing none, Mr. Alpert, well, just a moment. Commissioner Hoffbeck, his plane did land. If you want to come up and join him if you'd like, or you can stay back there. Either way. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Mr. Alpert, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm now moving to slide number 7 and the new header called Credits, What Worked, What Didn't. And obviously there's going to inevitably be a little bit of opinion in there, but we do our best to keep it to the fact. Certain credits that we've had on the books for years have never been claimed. I mentioned several times in this conversation already the small producer credit. There was a similar credit of up to $6 million for production from the Middle Earth or new frontier areas of the state that's been on the books since 2006. Since there is, as of yet, no production from those areas of the state, the new areas credit has never been claimed. Likewise, the Cook Inlet Recovery Act and the companion bill to it that came from the Senate side had a provision called a jackup rig credit, a very high credit of up to 100% on bringing new rig into the deep water in the middle of Cook Inlet and reaching certain goals. That credit was never used, although jackup rigs did come to Alaska. Because of certain restrictions that were embedded in that credit, the companies found it was easier to use the existing stackable credits, the well lease expenditure and the capital credit, and got equal or better benefit than having to go through the additional hoops that the jackup rig had attached to them. Similarly, the Frontier Basin 80% drilling credit has never, as of yet, been used because in many ways it's easier to use some of the other credits, although in the prior committee, the Otna Corporation said they did intend to use that credit before it sunset this year for their project in the Glen Allen area. So all the credits on this slide are going to be sunsetting in 2016, or at least scheduled to in existing legislation. There are other credits that are sunsetting. I mentioned the exploration and the small producer credit and its so-called slow sunset. And if you look at the numbers on slide number 9, the credits on the North Slope that have been refunded to date for exploration total about $270 million. That also includes the ones that we see next year before the end of the cycle of this program. North Slope exploration credits against liability, about another $190 million. Non-North Slope refunded $160 million. A non-North Slope against tax liability, there have been really none. Any exploration credits in the Cook Inlet were refunded. Additionally, the small producer credit on the North Slope has been used to offset $340 million in taxes, and on the non-North Slope area, about $60 million. So if you add up all those line items, about $1 billion has been spent through either appropriation or taxes not received on these two families of credits that are going to be sunsetting on us. Should the bill before you pass, House Bill 247, many credits will remain on the books, some of them in an altered form. The carried forward annual loss, or net operating loss, sometimes known as the NOL credit, is going to remain. That's a 35% credit right now on the North Slope, and 25% in Cook Inlet and elsewhere. The committee substitute before you reduces the annual loss credit to 10%. So that one would be going down on January 1st of 2017 in the legislation before you.
Cook Inlet all.
No, that's all on North Slope.
Right, but not the North Slope.
Not North Slope, right. And those are only available outside the North Slope. The 35% North Slope credit is not modified by the bill before you. The so-called drilling credits, what Representative Sadler referred to in this sheet as the QCE and the WLE, those were repealed in the governor's original bill, and they've been reduced to the 20% level in the Resources Committee substitute before you. The exploration credits outside the North Slope between now and 2022 remain in that 30 to 40%, the difference primarily being distance from other wells and other infrastructure, whether you're more or less than 3 miles from other things or whether you qualify for the 30% or the 40% category. Those exploration credits remain with us through the end of 2021. Continuing this thought on slide number 11, the Cook Inlet tax caps remain on the books. Just very quickly on this, Mr. Chairman, what was written into the PPT bill was, as we were going about a new tax regime on the North Slope, to hold Cook Inlet harmless meant what they put in statute was the tax rates and the price of oil and gas as they were in the year before the effective date of PPT, so the period between April of 2005 and March of 2006, are what's used to establish the tax rate on oil and gas in Cook Inlet. That means an oil tax rate of zero. All the oil fields at the time had a rate of zero. And the gas tax varies from field to field, but the weighted average is about 17 cents per 1,000 cubic feet on gas. The Cook Inlet tax caps are scheduled to sunset in 2022. There is no underlying tax that's consistent. There's a lot of bits and pieces of other tax regimes. The bill before you has a working group that's going to look at a new tax regime for Cook Inlet and other areas of the state that will replace the sunset and Cook Inlet tax caps between now and 2022. Meanwhile, in Middle Earth, I mentioned earlier the Frontier Areas Credit Bill of 2012. That had many features in it. In addition to the Frontier credits, it had a cap on tax rates in the Middle Earth area of 4% of the gross for the first 7 years of production. And that will be any new production that comes on will be locked into a 4% gross tax. We also have the LNG storage facility credit that came in at the same time. That'll provide state assistance for the major tanks for the interior gas utility and is also available for any smaller regional tanks that other gas utilities might choose to need. There's also the refinery infrastructure credit. This was mentioned in the hearing earlier this morning related to the Tesoro contract. It's up to 40% of qualified expenditures for specific projects of up to $10 million per year per refinery, and it sunsets after 2020. And I'm now at another section break.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I may direct this question to Commissioner Hoffbeck, although I may be getting a little ahead because I see there's some more analysis. But this section is titled Credits, What Worked and What Didn't. And you gave us a presentation on what credits have actually been utilized or actually been cashed in or applied. What metric do you bring to what has worked and what didn't? And if the purpose of the incentives was to reduce the decline in production to incentivize additional exploration, can you give us some idea of what evaluation criteria you used to describe what worked and what didn't?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. We have really had three categories that we looked at. One were was those that just were not used. They didn't work. They didn't incentivize anything. The credits just simply were never used. There's also a component of that of credits that we felt like, although may have been used, did not achieve some of the purposes that were intended. That's a little harder for us to talk about because of the specificity of some of that data. So, but that's kind of that. That's kind of that package. The ones that just we don't think actually achieved the goal. There's a second set that worked and maybe have served their purpose, and those are the ones that primarily in Cook Inlet that dealt with the energy security issues within Cook Inlet. They were successful. They did produce and get the activity that was desired. Gas was found as well as oil, and quite simply may have served their purpose, that energy security issue is no longer present, and they may not need to be on the books anymore simply because they did work. And then there's the ones that have an ongoing need into the future that are incentivizing activity and discussions with industry and some of the financial institutions that loan against the credits were thought to be the more critical components for incentivizing activity going forward. And those are the ones, frankly, that the governor left intact within the governor's bill.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck. So, again, you can probably presume that a credit that has never been applied for and never cashed in, never applied, did not work, however intended. But for those that you say in that second category that did work, how much precision can you decide? That, you know, I also sat through the governor or the mayor's planning programs about what we might do in the South Central Alaska if we did not have sufficient natural gas supply, and all the attendant emergencies and storm and drying that did. So, these credits, after the credits happened, we saw more exploration, we saw more production. How much precision can you bring to the effectiveness of the credits? What kind of analysis or modeling did you show how much effect those things had? There's other factors involved: world prices, climate, et cetera, but what specific modeling or analysis do you have that points to the actual working of them?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we didn't try and parse out what portion of the success was due to lifting RCA restrictions on price versus an increased price environment versus the credits themselves. They all combined to create the environment where there was an active activity in the Cook Inlet. We felt like it was a futile exercise to really try and determine how much to assign to each of those. We simply have concluded that whatever the combination of those that resulted in the gas that's been found in Cook Inlet, it's been found. There's long-term contracts. There's contracts being negotiated for even additional years right now in Cook Inlet. There's several discoveries that, quite frankly, are looking for a market. And they don't have it. So where we went from market looking for gas in Cook Inlet, now we really have gas looking for a market. And at that point in time, we have to kind of step back and say, particularly in light of the state's current fiscal situation, is that the best place to continue to invest, or can we step back from those investments right now?
Last follow-up, and I appreciate that. I don't know if it's a futile exercise because the purpose, the goal of this committee's hearings is going to be looking at the different tax rates and different conditions of the credits to try and figure out how much we should or shouldn't give or continue to give, and trying to, with the most precision possible, see what the most appropriate, most effective level is for this incentives. I was hoping you did have some magic tool in a box that said, this is how we decided, this right place, $25.5 million credit or $150, okay. But you're saying you didn't have that kind of analysis to support that level?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we didn't. I think, and quite frankly, because they all kind of came together at the same time, the RCA, the changes in the RCA restrictions, the increased price that producers were getting for the gas and the credits were all kind of occurred in a very tight time frame. It's really hard to say which one of those drove that. One of the things, and I think if Analytica does a presentation for you, they will make the statement that, at least if it's consistent with what they did in House Resources, that the price that's currently being achieved for gas in Coquitlam, that $6 to $8 price point, is sufficient to incentivize exploration and development anywhere in the world, and that it really doesn't need underlying credit structure at that price point. So.
Just a last comment. Through the chair,
Dave Sadler.
I will be probing to try and find out how to achieve the goal of incentivizing without spending more than we need to. This is kind of a market we're going to try and figure out. So it may be just what the market will bear, but I don't hear evidence of a precise methodology that allows you to set the credit at this level versus that level versus that level.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, if there's one overarching theory that the governor wanted to maintain in the modified system as we move forward was to protect the concept of the operating loss credit. That if we're going to be in a regime of a net profits tax, that the operating loss is in many ways a playing field leveler. That the incumbent producer in a net profits world spends a dollar, they reduce their taxable income, they save a certain number of cents of tax based on the tax rate. The new person who comes in to do work in Alaska, if they spend a dollar but don't owe taxes, we are going to pay them back with an operating loss credit in some ways so they get a comparable benefit to what the incumbent producer gets. So that was the one that we saw as at least part of the larger goal of diversifying the economy, bringing new players into Alaska, and having a fair playing field between the incumbent and the new players. And to follow up one thing Commissioner Hoffbeck just said, what Mr. Meyer talked about when he talked about the fields in Cook Inlet being profitable or at least a worthy investment decision, the one caveat on that was so long as they have a place to sell their gas. If they could drill enough wells to be able to produce the gas the way it should be produced from that new field, then there's no problem. The weakness that they might have is if they have to drill one well every 3 years because they don't have any customers, then the economics of those fields get a little bit upside down. And that might be the one place where there might be a need to provide additional credit support if there was desire to get those fields going in the Cook Inlet.
All right. Next we have Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alper, just on that specific point you were just talking of first, you talked about Cook Inlet, if there's enough gas to be able to sell or market. Can you give us an idea of the market conditions within Cook Inlet? They're exporting to Japan. I think that's for another, I don't know how many year contract, but can you give us an outlook on that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, we had a few slides on this topic, and I believe Director Feige of Division of Oil and Gas will be in tonight or tomorrow to talk a little bit more about this. I could say generally that the base utility consumption in Cook Inlet is in the neighborhood of 80 to 90 billion cubic feet per year. So when you talk about a trillion cubic feet, that's 25 trillion cubic feet of gas in Prudhoe Bay right now, a trillion cubic feet is about enough to last 12 years for the utility market in Cook Inlet. The exporting from the current Conoco facility is, as I understand it, a little bit sporadic. They, in the summertime when their demand is lower, they sell a few loads, but there's not a regular delivery schedule. The types of demand and the proven reserves that we know about that are behind pipe are in the neighborhood of about almost 15 years worth of supply for that market. And those which have been claimed to be proven by the new producers, primarily Bluecrest and Fury, would add another several years to that. And there's a lot of contingent supply in there as well. Once they start drilling, it's quite likely there'll be more than they've initially claimed. So a trillion two to a trillion six known in the ground, and a lot more theorized, possibly 10, 15 trillion cubic feet of gas.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, and I believe we understood we're going to get further in depth into that. Also, back to Representative Sadler, trying to figure out, basically, is the state getting a net loss or a net benefit as per the credits, you know, and the value to the state? Again, that's, if we could figure out a way to do that, it certainly makes looking at these credits in a different way, maybe. There's a value to the state, but that value can also come in several years in length and time and running out. So any expectations of when they may balance, or maybe they already are in some or aren't, I was kind of thinking along the same lines as Representative Sadler when he was questioning that, or actually before that, of how to measure the value on these credits, Mr. Chair. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Newman. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One sort of state expense, which is a real expense but isn't a purchasable one, is for North Slope fields. We have the GVR fields, and then we have the pre-2003 producing fields. When those fields are paying a profits tax, they also get to write off some of their expenses, 35% from their taxable income, right, for their operating costs and their capital costs. Is that not accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, with the assumption that the price of oil is higher, that the net profits tax was what's in play, then yes, their capital and operating spending would be subtracted from the price they receive from selling the oil to result in the what's called production tax value, which is a statutory term of art for net profits, and then the tax is a percentage of production tax value. For the newer fields that are eligible for the gross value reduction, the reduced tax, there's a further subtraction from that figure, an adjusted net, and at the 35% tax is taken of that adjusted figure.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. And then maybe you'll go into it later, which is fine. Leaving the debate about the Cook Inlet credits to the side for a moment, the discussion back then was would they work to get gas supply to South Central? But what portion of those credits are being paid for what wasn't intended, which is oil in Cook Inlet and gas in Cook Inlet that was being exported by Conoco's export facility?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, it's easier to answer the oil question than the exported gas, because the gas varies somewhat widely from year to year, and it used to be a lot higher. Part of how Cook Inlet adjusted to the supply uncertainty was to shrink to the just its base needs. The Agrium plant closed a few years ago. The Conoco plant has shrank its footprint dramatically. But we did look at, in response to a question that was asked in the prior committee, the oil versus gas issue. And to the best we could determine, about a third of the Cook Inlet credits has supported oil development and about two-thirds gas development.
Representative Garrett.
Yeah, and then just on Conoco's exported gas, we still essentially get a zero production tax or 17 cents per MCF for Conoco's exported gas as well. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, yes, all production from Cook Inlet is subject to that 17 cents. To be fair, or to be honest, it's actually less than that. Most producers in Cook Inlet fall into the category where they would qualify for the small producer credit, which could offset that 17 cents down as low as zero.
And then finally, Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
Is there any way to get a better sense year to year? I know it changes year to year. So we know that roughly a third of the credits are paid for oil. Is there any way to get a sense year to year what portion of those credits was paid for gas that we were exporting to Asia?
Sure. Yeah.
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. I think one of the things that we need to look at here is that gas wells don't really respond well to being turned up and down. They like to have a steady state of production. And so what you've seen primarily in your export is the excess production in the summer that's not, it doesn't have a market demand, versus something that I think is specifically developed for export. So I think it's a little difficult to attribute that as credits that went for gas that's, you know, wasn't supposed to. I mean, some of it is just simply the fact that you have to do something with the gas in the summer, and you just can't just shut the wells off. So,
The question is, I understand that. The intent was to incentivize local production, and I'm just curious how much money we're spending for producers who are exporting their gas.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we could certainly take another level of analysis to our previous analysis of the oil versus gas split and apply some sort of multiplier to the gas production, what was consumed locally versus what was exported. But the commissioner is right. If you look at the demand for gas in South Central monthly rather than annually, you'll see that it could be 10 times as high in January as it is in July, just because people are heating their houses with it.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having sat through some information about oil and gas taxes in a previous assignment, I want to make sure, I think it's important for those listening to understand some of the dynamics of natural gas production. There are some that might think that it's a zero-sum game, that gas exported is therefore not available to in-state users. So I'm not sure who's the best person to ask this. But doesn't increased production from the basins provide for increased production from the basins? So in other words, if there is a market for excess capacity or excess production that's exported, that actually tends to make more regular and sustainable and reliable the supply of gas for in-state. Do I have that understanding correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Senator, that is correct. I mean, to some level, that's absolutely right. For years, Agrium was that balancing point. I mean, that you had a steady state of production, and Agrium was one that could turn its use up and down for when there was market demand that needed to be local. So
to follow up,
Representative Sadler.
So from the tax incentives point of view, is there really a distinction between incentives used to generate gas for consumption in state versus that's exported? Is there any really valid distinction?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't know that we can do it other than applying the multiplier that I referenced in responding to Representative Guerra a few minutes ago. But I think your question brings up one more very successful credit that I haven't mentioned, which is the gas storage facility credit for Cook Inlet that was part of the Cook Inlet Recovery Act and provided economic support to build underground storage that has enabled that sort of seasonal stability where people could produce gas year-round, inject it in the ground in the summer and pull it out in the winter, especially with the absence of those industrial users that they could draw gas from.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to go back to the little bit of the conversation related to the within the Cook Inlet area, what the credits were going for. Of course, the goal was gas. Did we put any stipulations when we put the credit forward that the information that was presented to us to gain the credit had to be a resource that specifically that the resource was gas? I mean, if we stick a straw down the hole in Cook Inlet, we're going to hit both. So if oil came out of the hole, is there an indication that we're saying that the credit did not work because it didn't get gas? And I'm not saying that you are. Is that a thought process that it didn't do what we were intending it to do? What did we initially ask for that credit? What was the goal? What were the stipulations on that credit?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, there was no stipulation. It was qualified capital expenditure, drilling related to intangible drilling costs. I mean, there's lots of statutory language that talked about the work, but it didn't ever specify oil versus gas. To a certain extent, because of the nature of the drilling credits, once someone's drilling, they know what's there. They're drilling into the oil area or the gas area of their field. The drilling credits also are eligible for workover work, for example, where you have an active well, but you're modernizing it and improving the equipment. So I think it's reasonable that the companies knew what they were getting when they were doing these expenses, but we never did put any stipulation that it had to be for oil versus gas in the expenditure.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I guess before we leave
this. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I'm happy to leave this pretty soon. The only other part is, does the administration think it's fair to the residents of the state that we have either a 17-cent per MCF or even lower tax on gas that's being exported and not being used locally?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, to be clear, that's what the tax actually was back in 2005, 0 and 17 cents. So the intent of the legislature at the time was simply to not change it. Since that point, the price of gas has gone up. The markets have changed somewhat, but the 15 years was the number that was put in the statute. That was going to stay in place for 15 years. The governor, when we were developing this bill, did not want to change the Cook Inlet tax caps prematurely. He felt that that was something that people were investing, expecting it to occur. There is obviously a need, most likely not this year, but before a future legislature, sometime in the next 4 or 5 years, that we are going to need a comprehensive look at Cook Inlet taxes on oil and gas. And I would be highly surprised if it stayed at the 0 and 17 cent level. At some point soon, we're going to need a long-term tax regime for Cook Inlet.
Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, and I think this actually goes back to Representative Sadler's question a little bit on some of the credits that didn't get what we expected them to do. Certainly oil is still king. Even though gas is important to the state, oil is where the money really is in oil and gas development. And so the fact that these credits can be used to incentivize oil production in a regime where they're not paying an oil tax, I think is probably one of those areas where we think the credits didn't do exactly what we had hoped that they would do.
All right. Thank you, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to give a reminder for us that it wasn't that long ago that we were paying astronomical prices to heat our homes. We've just come through a relatively mild winter, and it's a beautiful day out in spring. But from my perspective, a lot of the credits should be used and should be targeted towards in-state use of affordable long-term energy, and in that sense, some of the credits are designed to, affect behavior of the industry. Some people think the credits are just money being thrown at a wall and see what sticks, because we really can't look through the confidentiality of the tax structure and who's actually gaining and actually what's being used the most succinctly and effectively for the state. When you go through this, are you going to delineate some of the credits aggregated which actually don't cost the state money in the long term? I mean, that we come out in the black with some of the credits as a result of some of the credits that are stacked, whether it's the refinery infrastructure credits or the exploration. Is there going to be a presentation on what's actually worked for the people of the state of Alaska, whether it's through in-state cost or in-state usage or for the Treasury specifically, as compared with just giving the industry credits because we're giving the industry credits and we have been taught to give the industry credits?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, towards the end of the presentation, I bring up some of the slides from a much larger sequence we did in the other committee on what we call life cycle modeling. The question often comes, even if we're not getting the production tax, what else do we get, royalty, other taxes? What's the net benefit to the state over time? And we've tried to show that based on different assumptions and scenarios. As the prices get lower, of course, the conversation gets a lot more bleak, where we never really get our money back from these things. But always there's the question of what are the other benefits other than benefits to the Treasury, and that's where it gets really gray. Now, there's jobs, there's energy security, to that point, we have a hard time addressing that in the context of the kind of analysis that we do.
Thank you. Just another...
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we go through these credits and we're looking at the modeling that was done for them, whether it was done now or in the past, could you make sure that you include the range of costs and oil and prices that were modeled so we understand what those were?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, We've tried very hard, and the governor wanted very hard to stay away from the underlying fight about oil taxes that has dominated this building for many years. The part of the reason we are here is that prices are so low, and part of the reason some of the problems we have, I believe, are because we did not adequately consider what might happen with some of our tax structure if prices went very low and stayed low for a prolonged period of time. There are some phenomena, some oddities to the system at very low prices. You know, likewise, back when ACES was before this body in 2007, no one looked at what happened when the price got much higher than $70 or $80 and just how high the rates got and just how extreme in some cases the revenues became. So we might have guessed a little too low at that moment in time. We might have guessed a little too high when SB 21 was here. And what we're trying to do is say, let's make sure we have a system that works at all plausible ranges of prices.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So just kind of thumbing through the packet there, there's a lot of conversation about Cook Inlet, but if I understand what we were just talking, what I heard earlier is it almost sounds like you guys or the administration is endorsing Section 31, which talks about the working group, which should go forward this summer to evaluate whether or not we should do some adjustments with Cook Inlet. That being said, should we be spending a lot of time right now talking about Cook Inlet if the goal is to put a working group forward to analyze those things?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, there's sort of a two-step process here. Right now, the state's support of ongoing development work in Cook Inlet is 60% for the most part, 50-60%. We spent $404 million on credits in the Cook Inlet area last year, which is a little bit out of scale with other elements of the budget and possibly anticipated needs. So the short-term desire of ramping down the Cook Inlet credits, getting that support to the 25 or in the CS before you now 30% level in the short to medium term is important purely from a fiduciary point of view, from the state's cash flow. Even with that change, we need to figure out what the taxes are going to be in 2022 when those caps go away, because what's in place is a hybrid of bits and pieces of SB 21 and ACES and other things that don't really add up to a complete tax regime. So the primary purpose of that working group is for the future, not for the immediate.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
And if you wouldn't mind, help me understand. Was the working group, did it come out of the House Resources Committee, or was that something that you guys placed in the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. That came out of the House Resources Committee. I think it was in response to the fact that they put a good share of the credits back into the system and said we want to do a working group before we make a final determination on them. We actually feel like there's more urgency than that there's some that I think are it's fairly, at least from our perspective, obvious that they can be reduced at this point in time. But there is the bigger picture of how do we balance now the credits with a tax regime that essentially doesn't exist. Long term, we've got to fix that problem. So we support it for kind of the long term perspective, but on the short term, we feel there's more urgency than just saying we aren't going to do this now, we're going to do a working group. Because quite frankly, we had over 30 meetings with industry ourselves. Senator Geisel had a working group. There were substantial meetings that various legislators have had with industry around the building. I think we have a pretty good idea what the issues are. So I would hate to think that we would just delay any action until next year just because we want to have a working group.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. So would the House Resources Committee concur with what you have just stated, that this was that what the intent of this working group is? Or is this the or are you speaking from what the administration feels that the goal of the working group should be?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. As it was presented in House Resources, my interpretation of the presentation was that they felt it wasn't ripe and they needed to have a working group to work the issue even harder. So I think that's their perspective. I think the administration's perspective is it is ripe and we do know some of the levers we need to pull at this point in time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure we keep making progress, but I do want to make one follow-up to Representative Guttenberg's question. The legislature has been held up for criticism for not planning on the effect of oil at less than 67% less than what it had been when some of these credits were put into place. So I guess I would just say we might want to keep in mind the need to consider the effects of continuing credits or modifying credits at the full price range from Lord zero to $200 a barrel, because you never can tell. Thanks.
Thank you. Continue, Mr. Alper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the next section beginning on slide number 12 is called Credit Cost and Perspective, and I get a little bit deeper into the numbers of what we spent and what we've got for it in these next few slides. So this is a slight update to the slide I presented last week. I've added FY16, which is almost finished. There was a $500 million appropriation cap in FY16. About $473 million of it is out the door, and we're pretty comfortable with predicting where the last 27 is going to go. So with all that, there'll be about $8 billion in credits claimed through the end of the current fiscal year, going back to the credit era in roughly fiscal year 2007. $4.4 billion against tax liability. I described this last week. This is mostly the offsets against taxes from the major producers on the North Slope. That, in some ways, is not a true credit, and then it's baked into the tax system. The tax rate was quite high, and then there was the credit that was expected. People knew that the majors would be claiming a certain amount of credits to reduce their taxes, so that 4.4 I sort of moved to the side. The $2.3 billion in refunded credits on the North Slope is for the new projects, the explorers that were developing new fields. Meanwhile, in the non-North Slope, a small amount used against liability because of those tax caps. We were able last year to value the tax caps themselves. We learned that the amount of taxes not paid because of those added up to in the neighborhood of about $100 million a year. That's what the production tax in Cook Inlet would have been had they said had L for PPT or whatever the tax regime at the time was, rather than those caps. And about $1.2 billion in refunded credits, again, very recently loaded. Those have grown exponentially since the passage of the Cook Inlet Recovery Act. So there's $8 billion out the door. That of the refunded credits, you'll see $3.5 billion, taking away the half a billion that's in the current fiscal year because they haven't been fully analyzed yet. Of the $3 billion that were spent through the end of the last year, $1.45 billion going to six North Slope projects that are now currently in production. So there's some data and details we could bring to you on that. Another $650 million on 13 North Slope projects that do not currently have any production. Some of them are works in progress that we do expect to see oil from. Some of them have been seismic projects or exploration projects from producers that aren't going to do anything. They've been abandoned. On the Cook Inlet or non-North Slope side, about $450 million on six projects that now have production, and another $450 that do not have any production. And the great bulk of these we expect will lead to something eventually, but a fair amount also is going to be abandoned as companies have left the state without going into production. But the next level of detail is interesting. We developed this for the previous committee. Of the $1.45 billion on the North Slope, and that's the number on this slide here, for the six projects that have production, through the end of FY15, we'd seen 38.5 million barrels of oil from those fields. And if you do simple division, the state credits are into those projects for $37.30 per barrel. Now, that seems very high. It's about what the entire market price of oil is right now. And to be fair, that number will absolutely decrease over time. Oil field development is invariably a front-loaded project. They've spent most of their money, and there will be more oil produced in future years that will somewhat dilute that number and make it smaller every year. But as of the end of 15, we had spent $37 a barrel on credits for those fields that were in production. That doesn't count the money that went to the fields that's not in production. Meanwhile, those six fields, spent just a hair less than $5 billion per their reported to us lease expenditures, which means our $1.45 billion refunded 29% of their lease expenditures. Taking a similar analysis to Cook Inlet, $450 million went to six producing projects. The total production, now that's a lot of gas in there, 55.9 barrel of oil equivalent. If you add it all up and call it as if it were oil, the equivalent value is $7.80 per barrel of oil, or $1.30 per MCF if it were gas. That's about a straight ratio of 6-1 for 1,000 cubic feet to a barrel of oil. That number, of course, will also decrease over time as additional production comes on. Meanwhile, the lease expenditures in Cook Inlet was about $1.1 billion, and not surprisingly, because of the more aggressive Cook Inlet credit regime, the state credit support was about 40% of spending on those Cook Inlet projects. One more slide in this vein is the Cook Inlet tax caps. I referenced it briefly. If you look at the midpoint of that number, it's about $700 million over the 7 years, and you take a rough, based on the production, is around 250 million cubic feet per day, or about 640 BCF of gas, which is the equivalent, if you divide, of 106 million barrels of oil equivalent, plus the average production in North Slope has been around, and on Cook Inlet, it's been around 10,000 barrels of oil a day. It got as low as 6 or 7. It's up to 17, 18 now. There's been some increase in oil production because of these credits. But using 10,000 as a rough average, that gets us to 132 million barrel of oil equivalent. I'm missing a million from that last small bullet. So dividing that into the $700 million that's been spent on through the tax caps, that's another $5.30 a barrel, or 88 cents per MCF. So if you were to add up the Cook Inlet tax caps and the direct credits, $1.30 plus 88 cents, best we could figure is $2.18 has been the state's support of gas development in Cook Inlet through the credits and the tax caps over the last 7 or 8 years.
Questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Alper, you made a comment earlier about the $8 billion that's gone out the door from FY 17 to 16. In fact, as the tax director, you're probably the best person possible to answer this question. I would like to know what the total value is of the oil produced on which those credits were earned from 07 to 16, including the production severance tax, including royalties, including the corporate income tax and the property tax. If you could provide that, I'd sure appreciate that. And further, if you could, there's some great breakdowns here. If you could break out the ratio of those total values to the value of the tax credits, that might help to give a better perspective on whether the credits have been working or not. Can you provide us that information?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we can. I just want to make sure I understand the question. We're talking about the specific resource that was incentivized through these credits for the oil and gas produced by the companies that received the tax credits, not all the oil and gas produced. Is that?
If you could prepare it both ways, that would be even more helpful.
And certainly the credits against liability are, you're going to be talking about really all of the production. That's where that $4.4 billion will be a function of the great bulk of the oil that we sell for our livelihood here in Alaska. The refunded credits will be much more the targeted smaller numbers that I was referring to in the subsequent slides. But yes, absolutely, Representative, we could do that.
I appreciate the value of that kind of analysis.
Thank
you. Correct me if I'm wrong, but does the state retain the seismic 3D work or 2D work and well data from wells that have been drilled using credits?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I'm going to answer to the best of my ability, and I'm going to hope that Director Feige, when she comes in this evening, can answer better. The short answer is yes, if the work was incentivized with a state credit, an exploration credit, or the capital credit for exploration, which is a subtype, they get the data, and under many circumstances, that data can be made public in 10 years, and that means that DNR actually uses it as part of their marketing of state lands to try to bring new companies up here.
And as I understand it, too, through the chair, that information is retained in the Geologic Materials Center and is available to help the state in marketing its future lease sales and drilling programs.
Yes. So through the chair, Representative Sadler, as I understand it, and once again, this is DNR's bailiwick. They have the data. They can use it for their own modeling and internal confidential purposes immediately, and under many circumstances, it becomes available to the public 10 years later.
And I believe, through the chair, I believe explorers who are interested in making investments in Alaska do sign confidentiality agreements and will go into the Geologic Materials Center and examine well logs and data presented to them, again, to help inform their decisions on what to bid for. So there's value not just to the state in 10 years, but up until that 10-year period, it is available to the industry. I won't ask you to allow for that value. I'm not sure if it's actually calculated, but there is value to the state in that.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes, Director Feige has, in fact, tried to value the seismic and other data that the state has received. It is substantial. If her numbers are to be believed, it's a large amount of money. What they're doing is comparing what it would have cost the state to go out and purchase all of that work themselves, of course, which is a relatively high number. The issue of seismic data is in some ways tied up in the impending sunset of the exploration credits. Depending on what the committee and the legislature does with some of the other credits, we were hoping to inject into statute some continuing mechanism to ensure that the state will get some of that data should the underlying exploration credits eventually fall off the books.
Appreciate that. Okay. I'll look forward to the data, too. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So couple questions here. One is trying to make sure that we're differentiating because we have a new tax regime that we haven't spent a lot of time in. So on 13 here, you highlight from FY17 to FY16, that's about $8 billion. What was ACES and what is SB21, both in the tax liability, the one that was against tax liability as well as the refunded credits?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the refunded credits were not changed dramatically on the North Slope with the change from ACES to SB21. Primarily, the type of company that was eligible for refunded credits in the last years of ACES was getting about 45% of their expenses repurchased between the 25% operating loss credit that was on the books at the time and the 20% capital credit stacked together. When SB21 came in, it eliminated the capital credit and replaced it with the 35% operating loss credit and then the sliding scale, which I'll get to in a moment. Because the developing companies were going to be reduced from 45 to 35%, and there was some concern that that might harm their projects that they were working on, there was a two-year hold harmless built into Senate Bill 21 where the net operating loss credit was increased to 45% for calendar years 14 and 15. So all of the credits that have been repurchased to date from the North Slope have been at that 45% rate consistent with the past. So that hasn't changed. On the credits against liability, just looking at the document that I brought before the committee, what we're really talking about under ACES was the 20% capital credit. And that, in a typical year, was $300 or $400 million. And that number, if you could imagine, works out to between $1.5 billion to $2 billion per year in allowable capital expenditures by the companies in the years in question. And it went up and down depending on the economy and what the companies were doing. The comparable credit since the passage of Senate Bill 21 is the per barrel credit. The per barrel credit was over $500 million, between $500 and $600 million in FY14 and 15, which was the 2 years it was in effect. So roughly the same, a little bit higher, but has very much fallen off the table with the decline in oil prices. The per barrel credit is estimated to be $28 million this year and $16 million next year. So within a rounding error of zero because of the very low oil prices.
Representative Pruitt.
So on the refundable, if I understand it correct, based on what you just said, we intended the first couple years of SB21 to be artificially higher. Is that a correct statement? In going into the future, we should see a decrease there?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, yes, we expected them to be the same, meaning that almost everyone getting the loss credit was also getting the capital credit. So we kept them at that 45% level. And that will be declining to 35%. And those numbers are baked into our forecasts. I mean, our forecasted numbers of repurchased credits go down as we move through the calendar in future years, some of it because we have incomplete data about what companies are going to do and we can only project based on what we know. But some of it, you are correct, is based on the fact that the main North Slope credit is declining from 45 to 35%.
Follow-up. Senator Pruitt.
Back to kind of the point of we can't really compare the last couple years. We can't really separate SB21 to its full extent at this point in time because we had the carryover hold harmless. At this point in time, though, going forward, I guess the question I have is there a reduction in the credits that's taken place from ACES to where we are now, to where we will be going forward from now?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we haven't seen it yet. The numbers have been creeping up, and granted, the Cook Inlet numbers in some ways are starting to drown out the North Slope numbers. Last year, the last completed year, FY15, at $628 million was the largest number of refunded credits we've ever had. This year was estimated to be $700 and was kept artificially low because of the governor's line item veto. It is fair to say that the North Slope refunded credits are actually on a downward trend. There was a slide that I presented to the committee last Thursday when I was here. It had blue and red graphics on it, and the blue wedge, which is the North Slope wedge, was trending down over the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
So in kind of the same vein, though, on the next page, you if you could help me understand the $1.5 billion that went into the six projects. First, I wanted to make sure that I understood that I'm using the correct terminology. What was the total amount that was spent on those projects? Is that the lease expenditures that you highlight on the next page, the 4.94?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, yeah, a bit less than $5 billion, $4.94 billion.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Is there, I guess really the real question is to find out, did the refundable credits do what we were intending them to do? And that would be to ask, what do we expect? How much money will be generated from the $1.45 billion that we invested or that we participated in the project? What do we expect the end amount to come to the state to be from that?
Yeah, and through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's a great question and obviously highly contingent on the price of oil. Whatever that number is, it's a lot less than we thought 2 years ago. And that's, you know, you'll see some of that with the life cycle modeling. Right now, the spring forecast has quite low oil prices going out 8 or 10 years, and there's very little revenue that comes in from especially the smaller fields that have the tax reductions in that paradigm. So, I don't know that I could adequately answer that question. The expectation at $100 oil was that there was a net benefit to the state. That benefit might no longer be there.
Yeah. Mr. Chair,
Commissioner.
Just through the chair, Representative Pruitt, just to kind of add on to that. I think because it's very difficult to separate what oil was actually credit specific versus not, I think the life cycle modeling, which takes a theoretical field, applies the credits and how much could be generated at different oil prices, is probably as instructive or more instructive than trying to go back and recreate how much we think maybe we've got out of the credits in the past, just because it's very difficult to determine how much is credit-related production and how much isn't. So,
okay. And, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
And then, I wanted to make sure that I just, when you're referring to, when we're talking about the total amount that will potentially come from in terms of investment, are you just speaking of the production tax, or does that also include royalties, property tax, all the other things that come out of that come from the investment that takes place?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, yes, the modeling that we did, the life cycle modeling, which is this a few excerpts from it at the back end of the presentation in front of you, it looks at three different analyses. One is just the production tax, the credits, and the tax. The second, which is probably much more relevant to you, is the total state take, the royalties, the corporate income tax, the property tax. A third one tries to look at the producer's economics, how they benefit from their spending offset by credits, and what their after-tax profits are going to be over the life cycle of the project.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, and then the last one is related to Cook Inlet, which would be the next page, or two pages after 16. So $450 million was spent between 7 and 15. So help me understand, we didn't have any tax from 07 to 10. We didn't have any qualified expenses, capital expenses. Why were we still dealing with brownout conversations? What triggered the change that took place where all of a sudden now we've got the boom going on in the Cook Inlet? I mean, it's if we didn't have a tax before, if we didn't have the qualified capital expenditures, it was already kind of a zero-sum game. What was the trigger?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, at the time PPT was being debated in this body, the Cook Inlet so-called gas wars were well underway, and a lot of the conflict, as I understood it, was in front of the RCA. At the time, the South Central utilities were used to a long history of very low prices, but there was a boom in prices in the lower 48. And there were proposals for gas sales contracts brought to the RCA to try to match Cook Inlet to Henry Hub. At the time, Henry Hub was, let's call it, $6 or $7, and the Cook Inlet price was $3 or $4. And the RCA rejected some of those contracts, and that led to a certain amount of disinvestment. People weren't going to drill wells to get the new supply on board if they weren't going to be profitable. Those earlier prices might have been workable in the earlier days when the production was booming, but to drill the new wells, it wasn't going to work. So that The field, the table was set for problems of gas supply just related to pricing issues. When that still hadn't resolved itself and we got to 2010, the body chose to create these new incentives as well as the gas storage. The gas storage, I think, was also predicated by the time Agrium closed down, the anxiety wasn't just about total supply, but seasonal supply. The brownout drills, and I've seen a lot of that paperwork. I'm fortunate enough to live here in the capital city, so I've never had to experience that myself. But it was all about the cold day in January and not being able to pull the 350 million feet per day rather than the 200 or whatever the normal day might be. And how can we pump enough supply on that very, very cold day to meet the spike? Especially when there isn't a full tank at an LNG facility or an Agrium plant that you could pull it back out of. And that's where that storage facility became essential and in many ways has solved a fair amount of the seasonality issues that exist in South Central.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We aren't even a third of the way through this presentation yet, and we're scheduled to go till just 3:30, and it's nearly 3 o'clock. So I'm going to have everybody hold your questions, make a note of your questions, and we'll get them answered at the end or later if we have to. Go ahead, Mr. Alford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This next section is a little bit mathematical, and it's more about the oil tax itself. You might want to take questions at the end of it because it might confuse some folks. This is Senate Bill 21, how the North Slope production tax calculation works, and I'm as it was written at around $100 oil, this is how the tax works on a single barrel of taxable oil. And just to put the numbers in perspective, there's about 160 million taxable barrels produced per year from the North Slope, and there's nothing magic in that number. If you take 500,000 barrels a day and multiply it by 365 and you subtract out the 1/8 of the barrels that are the royalty barrels, which aren't subject to the tax, they're about 160 million. So if you have a $100 barrel of oil, it sells in the marketplace, it costs about $10 to get it there through the pipeline and the marine transport. That has a gross value or a wellhead value of about $90. The lease expenditures in our current projections this year and next are about $35 a barrel. That's the operating and capital costs. So we have $55 worth of taxable net profits, or what we call production tax value. Senate Bill 21's regime is a 35% tax on the net. So 35% of $55 gets us a $19.25 tax, which is offset by that per barrel credit that I was talking about earlier. At $100 oil, that per barrel credit would be $6 a barrel. It's a sliding scale tied to the price of oil. So the real tax paid by the companies would be 13.25. In parallel with that, we do the minimum tax calculation, or the so-called 4% floor. You go back to the 90 that I got to before, the gross value. That number times 4% is $3.60, and what's paid to the state is a higher of. And of course, 13.25 is higher than 360, so we get the 13.25. You multiply that number towards 100 times 160 million taxable barrels, and we'd be getting $2.1 billion a year from the production tax. That's more or less where the thinking was a couple of years ago when we were last seriously talking about oil taxes. And $2.1 billion is very different than what we see today. When we get down to, say, $70 oil, which is where the expectations were during the last legislative session, or the fall before it anyway, at $70, that minimum tax starts becoming the dominant part of the conversation. And walking down the same calculation, $70 market price oil becomes $60 gross. The same $35 lease expenditures gets you to $25 net. A 35% tax on the $25 is $8.75. But the per barrel credit goes up as the prices go lower, and now it's $8. So 875 minus 8 is only 75 cents. Now when you go back to that $60 gross and take a 4% minimum tax calculation on that, that's $2.40. And the higher of, so to speak, is use the 240, multiply that by the volume, and the state would be getting in about $380 million in production tax revenue at $70 oil. That's a big drop-off from the $2.1 billion. Go a step further to where we are today on a good day. We're actually about 38.5 last time I checked. The price of oil around $40, and the producers start losing money because if it costs $35 in lease expenditures plus 10 in transportation, that's $45 in costs against $40 oil. So you get to a production tax value of negative 5, and all things being equal, and this is very much of a stylized calculation across the North Slope, and every producer is different. But we could assume at $40 oil that our producers are going to lose in the neighborhood of $800 million a year producing their oil and selling it from Alaska. If we were to go through the exercise of calculating a net tax on that and subtract the per barrel credit, it doesn't really do that because the production tax value can't be below zero and all that. But to do the calculation, you end up with a what would effectively be a negative $9.75 tax. That one, of course, isn't used. The minimum tax, which is 4% of the $30 gross, is the actual tax that's paid, $1.20. And $1.20 leads to a tax paid of $190 million of revenue to the state at $1.20. But meanwhile, the companies are actually experiencing an operating loss credit of $280 million, 35% of their losses. So what gets really interesting, which is where we are now, is when you get $40 oil for a second year in a row, when you have very low prices for a consecutive year. So the first column that you see before you is the same calculation as on the previous slide. The company, they paid $190 million in taxes, which in a style, it's similar to what they paid last year, but they have this carry forward loss. What happens in year two, you get to the same calculation, you get to that minimum tax calculation of $190 million, but current law allows the major producers to use a carry forward loss credit to offset their minimum tax as far as zero. So in other words, the floor has not been hardened against the loss credit, and it could be used to offset it down to zero. So with to use these stylized examples, with $190 million in tax law obligation and $280 million in carry-forward loss, you use $190 million of it to offset the taxes. They have yet another $90 that they carry forward further, plus the $280 that they earned on this year, and now they have $370 million of carry-forward loss credits that could be used in year three against whatever the tax liability is in year three. So what you start to see, and when Deputy Commissioner Burnett and Dan Stickle were here the other day, last Tuesday, talking about the spring forecast, they talked briefly about very high operating loss credits carry-forward because of many years of expected low prices. This is the calculation and the phenomenon that we were really talking about in that context and how you get to these large carry-forward credits. Now, I want to put a couple of caveats in what I just said. This is just the baseline scenario for legacy oil from the North Slope. I was treating it as if it was all the same. In fact, only about 91% of the oil from the North Slope is calculated in this way. The other 9% is the so-called new oil that qualifies for the gross value reduction, the new oil tax break. The main difference at higher prices is that it's a lower tax. The main difference at lower prices is that the GVR eligible, the new oil, is not subject to the minimum tax, and it could actually pay zero under current law. So that's the main difference there. We could provide comparable sample calculations for how the tax works for the GVR eligible oil, for Cook Inlet oil, Cook Inlet gas, and the like, if the committee so desires. I just did this here for the baseline North Slope legacy oil, just to show how the tax calculations work.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's next is, starting with slide 24, is what's actually in committee substitute for House Bill 247 resources, /I, the bill before the committee. And I've broken it out into five or six core portions of the bill. I mentioned earlier that the exploration credits are sunsetting. They're going away. The governor's wish was that they be allowed to sunset and not be extended, and that has been maintained in the committee substitute. The great bulk of the alternative credit for exploration and its subcategories are going to go away on July 1st, with the exception of the Middle Earth, which has previously been extended until 2022. The so-called jackup rig and Frontier Basin credits will be expiring in 2016 as well, but the interior areas of the state are still eligible for the Middle Earth exploration credits. We also went in and found a couple of older exploration credits on the books that have not been used for many decades. These are generally offsets against royalty. They're in DNR statutes, and we are preemptively repealing them so they don't get resurrected in the era of after the old exploration credits go away. So that's the exploration side. Cook Inlet credits is a two-slide sequence. First, I wanted to lay out what the current situation is under current law. Right now, the 25% net operating loss credit can be stacked. I underline that word because we use it a lot. It means you could take the two credits at the same time. And what it can be stacked with is either the 20% capital credit, the QCE, or the 40% WLE credit. In general, a given company's set of expenditures in a given year is going to be a weighted average of the two. Some of their expenses are going to qualify at the high level. Those that don't will generally qualify at the low level. So somewhere around 30% comes in, and then the state will refund between 50 and 60% of a company's costs while they're in development. Interestingly, for the existing producer, if you're producing oil and gas, profitable or not, from Cook Inlet, you don't pay any taxes because of the tax caps. You don't have an operating loss, so the operating loss credit doesn't apply, but you're still eligible for that 20% capital and 40% well lease expenditure credits, which means the state's going to pay somewhere in the 25 to 35, generally around 30% of the costs for these incumbent producers in Cook Inlet who, once again, don't pay any taxes due to the cap. That's the existing situation that the governor and the Resources Committee are addressing with the changes in the bill before you. So what's in the CS is that we're reducing the operating loss credit from the 25% rate to the 10% beginning next January. Meanwhile, the well lease expenditure credit, the 40% credit, gets stepped down to 30% in 2017 and 20% in 2018. Now, because those WLEs are a subset of the capital credits, reducing it to 20% is effectively the same as repealing it, because it's the same expenditures. Whether you call it a QCE or a WLE, it's the same stuff, and you're going to be just getting the 20%. The committee substitute keeps the QCE credits in place through 2022. There is a repealer put in that we did not have for these credits in 2022, the idea being that we're going to have a new tax system in place, so let's just clear the decks and make sure that we can start from scratch beginning in 2022. What does that mean in practice for the new field developer is the state will be refunding around 35% of the company's costs in 2017 and 30% in 2018 and beyond. For the existing producer, for the company under production, we're now getting, what did I say previously, 25 to 35%. The expectation is those companies will be getting 20% of their capital spending refunded by the state going forward. Now, what the CS tries to do, as I understood it, was to set the path towards the broader Cook Inlet tax reform by 2022. Another area of law that we look to address in the bill, which the committee substitute took up, was the idea of a repurchase limit. This doesn't really speak to how much credit can be earned. It speaks to how much the state is willing to buy back in a given year. We're saying you can have them all. You effectively have a credit certificate, but some of those certificates you might have to hold on to for a while. The rolls certain liability forward. And what the committee substitute did was add a cap on per company credit repurchases of $200 million per company per year. Now, that's not that hard a cap. First off, $200 million is already a very large number, and it's possible that if you had a very large project with two or three or four partners, each of them could get that $200 million the way the CS is written. So that would mean $600 or $800 million. It did specify that a single company couldn't artificially split themselves up and create Ken's Oil Company A and Ken's Oil Company B and try to claim it twice, for example. This provision was left in the bill. It's substantially different than the governor's original version, but it was left in there primarily to protect the state's interest against a very large outlier project such as has been discovered and proposed by Mr. Armstrong and the project they were working on with Repsol on the North Slope, which we did modeling of a comparable project to show that the state could potentially be liable for up to $800 million a year in tax credit payments to that single project years in advance of getting any revenue from actually producing oil from it. So this is something of an insurance policy at the very, very high end. To put that cap in perspective, we look back into our records of repayments of credits. Going back from the beginning, 2007, through the current year, there has been exactly one instance of a company receiving more than $200 million in a single year. I can't tell you who and when, but it did happen. There was once a time where we gave someone more than $200 million in a year. In addition to that, there have been five other times where a single company got more than $100 and less than $200 million in a year, and another 11 instances where a company got between $50 and $100 million. So 17 transactions, for lack of a better word, Mr. Chairman, where the state paid more than $50 million a year to a single company in refundable tax credits. The next provision of the bill is we're talking about exceptions or loopholes. These are some smaller, somewhat more obscure provisions that we discovered that might be causing some unintended consequences and some artificially high credits. The CS is retaining two of them that we put in the bill. One of them, and I go into it with a little bit more detail modeling later on, is you can't use your gross value reduction to increase the size of a net operating loss. And it's not intuitive, and I get to it in a couple of slides, but that calculation, which was not anticipated because no one thought about what happens when a company who's producing and thus eligible for the GVR is also losing money. When you combine those two things together, we had circumstances where we could actually pay more than loss credits of more than 100%. And obviously that was not intended, and the committee kept that fix on the books. Another oddity that we discovered because of an unusual sentence structure in existing law, if you have a utility, if you have a municipal entity that owns a gas field, and they sell that, and they use most of that gas themselves because they also own a utility and they burn it on their own turbines, but they sell some small fraction of that gas to a third party because they have a little bit of surplus, we found that their revenue becomes only the tiny amount that they sold, but their expenses becomes all of their expenses, and it created some very large synthetic operating losses, which could lead to some very large and really unearned credits that the state was in a position to pay in previous years. The CS retains language that cleans that up. So I'm now on slide 31, and I go into a little bit greater detail on the so-called GVR NOL problem. And if you're curious how the language is, it's in the bill in section 12, sub B2 of AS 4355023. So the gross value reduction is a subtraction factor. You take some fraction of your gross value and you subtract it from your taxable net, your production tax value. In the scenario I presented the next slide, it says, well, what if that net value is below zero? It actually creates an enhanced, an artificially large loss to which you apply the multiplier that is the operating loss credit. So, in effect, the 35% operating loss credit could become, in the example, about a 70% operating loss credit, which if you multiply a typical small field over the course of a year, could cost the state an extra $7.6 million. So let's get into the numbers here, and I hate putting big tables in front of the committee. Their numbers are small and sometimes hard to read. But this is a similar format to what I used in my tax modeling slides a few slides back. You at $40 oil, this uses the example of $36 in lease expenditures. The field in question, they're losing $6. But because of the way the gross value reduction is, they get to subtract 20% of their gross is 30, so they're subtracting another 6 and actually getting an adjusted production tax value, the number circled in red in the first column, of negative 12. If you apply the operating loss credit to that negative 12, they end up with a $4.20 tax credit against what's really a $6 loss if you're looking at their actual cash flow. So that's a 70% loss credit. What we're proposing is if the company is in a loss, you can't further subtract the gross value reduction. You have to add that feature back in before you calculate the tax. So we would be looking to pay an operating loss credit of 35% of only the actual cash flow loss, the $6. And instead of paying $4.20, we'd be paying $2.10. In other words, a 35% operating loss credit as the underlying law is intending, we believe. So that's the fix in Section 12 of the bill, and I'm sorry if that was too fast and too complicated, and I'm happy to explain it to members outside the committee if people want to go into it in greater detail. Slide 33 is the other outlier loophole provision that was retained in the bill, the municipal utility problem. And in the little table there, I won't worry about the text because I've just sort of explained it. Imagine a company under current law, the left column here, if they're producing 20 million cubic feet per day and 18 of it are burned in their own utilities turbines, but they're selling two and they're selling it for $8 and they might be selling it to another utility, say, over the course of the year, they'd get about $5.8 million in revenue. If you subtract all of their lease expenditure developing all of that gas at $3 a 1,000 cubic feet, just to pick a number, that costs them $22 million. That's a $16 million paper loss, and they would be eligible for a $4 million operating loss credit. Obviously, that company doesn't have a $16 million loss. The great bulk of their spending was spent on gas that they get to produce and use in their own utility. So we need a way to prorate that out and say, no, if you're only selling 10% of your gas, you should only get to deduct 10% of your expenses. And that's the calculation in the bill's proposal on the right-hand column, showing that it's effectively profitable and they're no longer eligible for an operating loss credit. And again, that could I could walk through that technical calculation outside the committee if anyone wants to go through there, or if you wanted to entertain questions, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to go there. Here we are now on slide 34 and other provisions of the committee substitute. Interest rate, there was an error. We believe it to be a technical error. It came in very late in Senate Bill 21, in its very last committee, and in this room, in fact, that we believe accidentally eliminated compound interest since 2014. This isn't just oil tax. This is all taxes that the Department of Revenue administers. We've only been charging simple interest on taxes. The bill restores compound interest effective next January. The interest rate in the current bill remains 3% above the federal discount rate. That's a number that adjusts quarterly. Right now, the federal discount rate, the Federal Reserve rate, is 1%. So the state is getting 4% interest on delinquent taxes today as we speak. Other things that were put in there to protect the state's interest in event of a company's bankruptcies or defaults. The state currently has the ability to hold back a credit if the company owes taxes to the state. That's existing law, and it's only common sense. If someone owes us taxes, if they're delinquent, we should be able to use their money to pay their taxes before we pay them back the credit. We are expanding that ability to say, well, what if they also owe a royalty or a lease payment or a fine to another government agency related to their oil and gas operations? And that sort of protection to state interest is retained in the bill, although it's written somewhat differently than originally proposed. There's another provision which was added by amendment in the previous committee to provide a surety bond for field developers. There's been some concern, especially in the Kenai, where a developer went bankrupt and leaving a lot of local vendors with unpaid bills, but all of their money went to their secured creditors, their banks back east. In fact, there were instances where companies, there was a large fuel vendor who had to pay back something like $100,000 to the bankruptcy court that they had previously been paid, because there's some 90-day clawback provision that money was truly the property of some outside secured creditor. The hope is that some sort of surety bond specifically to protect unsecured creditors in state could be put in place to help work around some of those interests. And although the language might need a little bit of work, the concept we believe is excellent and hope that it survives into the final version of this bill. So that's the committee substitute. Mr. Chairman, beginning on slide 35, I just want to briefly go into the changes made in the previous committees to have a better flavor for what was in the original version of the bill as proposed by the administration. The bill kept and improved upon, frankly, many of the technical fixes of the bill, the things that I talked about in the last slides, including that double dip credit for new oil in the North Slope, the GVR net operating loss problem. The committee substitute reduced our rollback and somewhat deferred the rollback of the Cook Inlet credit. They reduced them. The governor's bill originally eliminated them more immediately and more dramatically, a different emphasis as well, and I'll talk about that in a moment. They increased the repurchase cap, made it a larger number as far as how much the state can pay in a single year to a single company. The committee substitute eliminated all the changes that were made to the so-called minimum tax, the hardening of the floor, as well as an increase to the floor. The original bill also had an interest rate increase and several smaller provisions. And the committee substitute added the working group that was discussed earlier in this hearing on looking at a new tax regimes in Cook Inlet and other areas outside the North Slope. Drilling down into the three biggest pieces of that, starting with Cook Inlet, the original proposal from the governor was to repeal the 20% capital and 25% well credit while maintaining the full 25% operating loss. The committee substitute did three things, made three substantial changes. The first related to timing. The original bill had an effective date of July 1st of this year. The committee substitute phased those changes in over 18 months, not taking full effect until January 2018. The committee substitute retained a 30% rate of level of development support versus 25 in the original bill. But if you recall, the CS has a 10% operating loss and a 20% drilling. So the third part is the applicability. With that 20% support for producers who might earn a profit but don't pay taxes, that's very different than the 0% support that the original governor's bill proposed. It means, effectively, it's not just the gap between 25% and 30% or an additional, say, 20% in costs. It does open the door to a broader set of companies who will, in fact, be eligible for cash credits from the state because of the 20% credit support maintained for companies who don't have an operating loss. The second suite of changes relates to the repurchase limits. The original proposal added four limits. Currently, there's exactly one limit on repurchase. That's existing law, and I mentioned it at the beginning of my presentation. If you have more than 50,000 barrels a day, you can't get cash. You have to carry your credits forward. We're looking to amend that section of law to add these other limitations. The first one, we started with a per company per year cap of $25 million. That was the number that was in place back in the PPT law in 2006 and 7. We also said, if you're a very large company, if you have annual revenue in excess of $10 billion, colloquially we said, if you're bigger than us, if your economy is larger than the state of Alaska, then maybe you can hold your credits on your own balance sheet and not get refunded, and you could hold them forward until you have a tax liability. You became ineligible for any credit repurchase based on your global revenue. We added a third restriction that said, if you're able to get $10 million, but you only have 75% Alaskan hire, well, we're only going to refund $7.5 million, and you could hold the other 25% until you have a future tax liability, so a further scale down tied to a percent of Alaska hire. And finally, we put a 10-year sunset on carried forward credits. So that was a relatively dramatic cutback as proposed in the original legislation. The impact of the changes is, of course, a large percentage of the projected savings, what we had in the original version of the fiscal note of the bill, were in these specific provisions, in the repurchase cap. So a tighter repurchase credit, loosening the repurchase limits puts a lot more money back into the credit system. However, tightening the repurchase limits will actually increase the carried forward credit number, the future liability that I spoke about earlier, and by carrying them forward, that will impact our future production taxes. And there should be a word at the end of that slide. It should offset future production taxes if more credits are carried forward. Finally, the third major change was in the realm of strengthening the minimum tax. The minimum tax I spoke to earlier, the so-called 4% floor, there's really three different issues related to the minimum tax that impact legacy producers and others that impact the new oil producers. So first off, when the governor's original bill proposed that you can't use an operating loss credit to reduce payments below that 4% floor. That's the $190 million I had about 10 slides back that said you could use a carry forward credit to go below that floor to zero. And that single line right there, that is the largest by far line item in the original fiscal note as far as the additional revenue goes, as far as the new dollars actually coming in, would be that hardened minimum tax for the legacy producers. Another change we made, which is a little bit more technically complex, says that the per taxable barrel credits, the $8 or sliding scale credit, if you earn it in 1 month, you have to use it against that month's taxes, that it can't migrate to other months within a year at the time of annual true-up. That is a provision that is not relevant today, but it was very relevant in 2014, where we found if you have a year where you have certain months of high oil prices and they're paying a tax after the subtraction of the $8 credit or the $5 credit beyond the minimum tax, but you have other months of the year where you're limited by the minimum tax year sometimes has surplus unused credits, and those credits can be migrated to the earlier months. And the real number in 2014, we ended up paying about $110 million in refunds because of the what we're calling the migrating credit problem, and we were seeking to clean that up in the governor's original version of the bill. The governor also sought to increase the minimum tax from 4% to 5%, which has a rough fiscal impact of about $50 million. Meanwhile, as far as the new oil producers, we look to extend the minimum tax to gross value reduction eligible new oil. Right now, the $5 credit on new oil can go below the minimum tax all the way below zero. We also sought to require to not use the small producer and exploration credit to go below the the so-called floor. So we're trying to harden the floor against all credits and say everyone has to pay the minimum tax. So those were the provisions that were removed in the committee substitute. Mr. Chairman, I can rush. I can pause any time. I could take questions. I only have the one presentation, and I'm also on the agenda this evening. So whatever slides are left when we finish today, I'm prepared to pick up where we left off tonight. I could
This evening, we have DNR back tonight, and we'd probably be able to shove all of it together if we have to. Do you want to continue right now, or do you have – we've got about 10 minutes if we want to continue for the next section here.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, the next section is a kind of a snapshot look at the fiscal note. The fiscal note's a five-page document, and I can go through it in greater detail at another time. But – Real, you can break the provisions of the bill out into three main sections, you know, two related to spending. You have your credits that are being eliminated or reduced and your credits that are being deferred, meaning we're telling companies that you can't have all the money now, you have to take it in a future year. And then there's also the increased revenue. And then among those, you could further divide North Slope versus Cook Inlet. And on the increased revenue, we try to parse out the floor hardening from the floor increasing. And you can see that the bill is originally proposed. I mean, it says $785 million. It wasn't that when we proposed it. It was only about $500. There's been a dramatic increase because of the changes in the spring forecast, that the fall forecast had they had lower credit expectations for FY17. With those higher credits, you also see higher numbers of credits deferred. And with lower prices, you see a greater impact from hardening the floor than we originally anticipated. So between those two pieces adding up, our bill would have actually been a $785 million impact. Were it to take effect on July 1st in its fullness, the committee substitute has very little impact in fiscal year 17, simply because it doesn't take effect at all until January 1st of 2017, so we're already halfway through the fiscal year. And then those provisions that defer credits and harden the floor have been removed. The $200 million cap is the remaining credit deferring provision in the committee substitute. That does not have a material impact in the fiscal note because we don't see any companies earning $200 million or more in the six-year period covered by the fiscal note. So all we see is the benefit from the eliminated and reduced credits, the changes to the North Slope GVR net operating loss issue, and the ramp down of the Cook Inlet credits, which I just described. In FY18 is probably a more appropriate comparison because the FY17 credit spike goes away and the bill is more fully implemented. The original bill had a $435 million impact, roughly split between the revenue and the spending side. The committee substitute will save the state about $70 million in operating spending based on the reduced credits. In FY18, a reduction from $390 under the governor's bill, $50 million in the committee substitute. So that's the lay of the land, and these numbers reflect the larger and more detailed fiscal note with all its associated narrative that we previously provided to the committee. So I wanted just to take a minute and just talk about the spring forecast and why the numbers are so different than they were. I did discuss this briefly a minute ago. First off, it's not just that the prices are lower, but they're staying lower for a longer period. So you see these large company operating losses and larger losses carried forward. The status quo production tax at $40 gets very close to zero, because at $40, we project all three of the major producers will have operating losses, and in the status quo would be using those operating losses to reduce their gross minimum tax to zero. So the state will be getting effectively nothing from the production tax. However, we'll start accruing and stacking up these large carry-forward NOLs, and we estimate 630 million of them will be on the books at the end of FY17. Meanwhile, we had a $200 million increase in the credit estimate. You may recall the number was 625, and the fall and the spring update brought that up to 825, or 200 more. Why is that? Two things, really. One is companies are losing more money. We have bigger operating losses because the price of oil is lower. And the second one, which was a little bit surprising to us, that in Cook Inlet and especially in the North Slope, the exploration credits are about to sunset. So without us doing anything, the state is going to go from paying for 75% of an exploration project to paying for 35% of an exploration project. You know, we saw some companies that were ramping up their exploration work and getting some wells in under the wire to try to get that higher level of support. And that's a one-time effect, but it is an effect, and that led to a few more dollars in that spring 16 forecast as well. Last year, by the way, in 2015, the credit support rate for exploration was 85% on the North Slope. That's the reference point at the end of that last line there. Yes, in future years, the credit forecast does appear to decrease. Some of that is because the credits themselves are ramping down, but a lot of that is based on lack of detail in our future knowledge, that we don't know what companies are going to do more than 2 or 3 years from now, more than 1 or 2 years from now, really. So our credit forecast could only include our known projects. Anything new, anything that a company might sanction between now and the future is not currently built into our credit forecast, so it would have to be adjusted in there. I talked about that big Armstrong project. There are no development credits for that in there. Should they sanction that project, we will have to rethink and recalculate all of the numbers. And if you go into our production forecast and the wedges of oil we have under consideration, under development, the similar risked methodology that goes into those production forecasts is also risking the credit forecasts. Mr. Chairman, I really don't want to go any further because the next section is pretty complicated going into the scenario analysis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alper and Commissioner. We have other meetings that we are going to attend. Our next meeting is to be at 5 p.m. this afternoon, where we'll come back and continue Department of Revenue presentation on House Bill 247, and then we'll delve into the Department of Natural Resources, and we'll be able to ask questions at that later meeting. So with that, at 3:25, we are adjourned.